So this is a very explicit case in the Noble Book of Quran. Yaqub is mourning for sure for Yusuf alayhi salam for many years, to the extent that it's not a usual mourning.
Okay.
I mean, he became blind.
Yes.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
And then we have some, as I mentioned, general principles mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran. One of them is the verse 23 of chapter Ash-Shura, قُلْ لَا أَسْأَلَكُمْ عَلَيْهِ أَجْرًا إِلَّا الْمَوَدَّةَ فِي الْقُرْبَى. Say, I do not ask of you any reward for it, for the mission of the Prophet, except the love of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam. And for sure, I mean, the love for the Ahlul Bayt and the love of the Prophet has different manifestations.
Yes.
And one of them is that we need to be happy when they are happy, and we need to be sad when they are sad.
One of the signs, in fact, is that, for example, when the Ahlul Bayt are sad, and we know that the greatest mourner for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam now is Imam Asr.
Exactly.
So he is holding such mourning, we can say, sessions for him. So if we love Imam Asr, we have to be like him.
Now, imagine you, for example, as a boy, you love a girl, and that girl, I mean, she has, I mean, she is sad for any reason. Does she accept from you to show your happiness in front of her? Of course not. One of the reasons that proved your love toward her is that when she is sad, you also, you need to be sad, because of her sadness.
That's right.
So, as Muslims, this Quranic verse is asking us for love for the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. And all people agree that one of the signs for this love is that when they are happy, we need to be happy. When they are sad, we need to be sad.
Yes.
And which sadness is greater than the sadness for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala? There are many narrations in this regard.
That's right.
For example, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has chosen for us some Shia who help us, وَيَفْرَحُونَ لِفَرَحِنَا وَيَحْزَنُونَ لِحُزْنِنَا. They are happy because of our happiness, and they are sad because of our sadness and grief.
That's right.
And Imam Rida alayhi salam told the son of Shabib that if you want to be with us in paradise, then وَفْرَحْ لِفَرَحِنَا. Be happy because of our happiness, and
that's
be
right.
sad when we are sad. So this is one of the principles in the Noble Book of Quran, the fact that we need to love the Ahlul Bayt, and one of the manifestations of this love is to mourn for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam because of the sadness of the progeny of the Imam. The other verse in this regard is verse 32 of chapter Al-Hajj. The verse reads, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وَمَنْ يُعَزِّمْ شَعَائِرَ اللَّهِ فَإِنَّهَا مِنْ تَقْوَى الْقُلُوبِ.
Yes.
Those people who respect the signs of Allah or venerate the sacraments, then surely it is the outcome of the piety of the hearts. Now, we have the concept of ta'zim sha'airillah.
Yes.
To venerate, to respect the signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, there are many discussions about this title, this, I mean, concept, to venerate
Allah.
And sha'airillah.
Yes.
And the scholars believe that whatever shows that you are, helping the people remember God. This is a sign of God.
Yes.
So,
and Nahzat al-Husayni, as a result, is a sign of the manifestation of divinity of Allah.
Exactly.
Okay. Yes.
So, for sure, this verse is including all the actions which help the religion of God to be revived.
Okay.
And every year, I mean, practically speaking, we see that. That the mourning ceremonies for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam increase the piety of the people.
The spirituality
of the people. Okay. I mean, and one of the reasons is that the statistics show that Less sins are committed by the people, okay. For example, especially during the first 10 days of Muharram
and the month of Ramadan.
And the month of Ramadan, yes. In the communities which these sessions are held.
Yes.
So this is, a reality that mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam is one of the ways through which we can do the ta'zim, the veneration of the Sha'air Allah, the signs and sacraments.
And the people find a kind of unity and conformity, among each other, wearing black, giving endowment or their nuzurat for the sake of him, helping the poor. And all in all, we could find this is Sha'air Allah,
Exactly. What happens in these majalis is that people come to learn the religion from the scholars. One of the, important parts of every morning session for Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Yes, that's right.
Religious scholars come to talk to people about God, about the Quran, about the spirituality, and of course about the uprising of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So through these sessions, people increase their connection to God. Let me share an interesting story which happened to me today. I was in a marketplace and I found two teens talking to each other. They were talking about, having some, illegal relations to some girls.
Okay.
And one of them said to the other, I heard that this is the month of Muharram. Let's do it after the month of Muharram.
Okay.
This is a reality. For many people, they stop committing sin during the holy month of Ramadan. This happens in almost all the Muslim communities. The same is happening, especially for the Shia, during the month of Muharram and Safar, and especially the first 10 days of Muharram, because of the fact that these sessions help the people remember God again.
Mm-hmm.
Why in the holy month of Ramadan people feel a kind of
commitment to their religious background, or at least they do not do sinning or committing sin in public.
Is happening in these majalis for Imam Hussein alayhi salam, because the scholars talk about God, talk about the Day of Judgment, talk about the religion, the Quran, and so on and so forth, and the religious duties of the people.
That's right.
So we shouldn't think of it as a kind of innovation. As I mentioned, it is mentioned explicitly in many narrations. It is mentioned explicitly in the case of Yaqub, and implicitly in the verse of Mawaddat fil Qurba, in the verse of Ta'zim Sha'air Allah, and also the verse 148 of chapter An-Nisa, لا يحب الله الجهر بالسوء من القول إلا من ظلم. We do not have time.
Not allowed to shout unless it is against a kind of oppression.
Exactly.
Okay, and for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, we are shouting for justice.
Exactly.
We are shouting in his morning ceremonies.
Thank you for that summary. Yeah.
Increasing our voice for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the oppressions that were done toward him. That's all right. All in all, we could say that we can say reviving the memories of Nahzat al-Husseini is in the same path of Sha'air Allah, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept whether Azadari or morning ceremonies for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam have Quranic roots or proofs or not. It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
And thank you very much, dear listeners. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi aman Allah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي بتهران. Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Saudi Lidwo in Yemen is still taking its toll on the nation, even under the UN brokered truce. Yemen's Ministry of Health has held a press briefing in Sana'a to highlight the catastrophic repercussions of the Saudi aggression and the impact of the ongoing siege of Yemen.
We held this press conference to review the impact of the Saudi aggression since its beginning, as well as the aftermath of the siege amid the UN armistice, which unfortunately did not change anything. There are tragedies caused by the Saudi-led coalition throughout the years of war, as health facilities and workers have been targeted, and we explain to the world what is happening in our country under the eyes of the United Nations and with the support of the US, Britain and the rest of major powers.
The ministry says the ongoing Saudi blockade is threatening the lives of thousands of patients by preventing them from traveling for treatment and blocking medical supplies from entering the country.
The blockade is part of the fierce war on Yemen and has directly affected the health sector due to a lack of fuel and failure to fully open the Sana'a International Airport. There are more than 32,000 patients who urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. Saudi Arabia also tends to prevent the entry of medicines that are essential for the treatment of millions, including radioactive iodine, which is used to treat cancer patients.
Even though the United Nations managed to declare a nationwide ceasefire back in April, it has failed to relieve the humanitarian situation in Yemen, as Saudi Arabia is still imposing restrictions on all sorts of imports into the country.
According to health officials, 19 million Yemenis don't have access to basic health care services. They say the United Nations is concentrating its efforts on the Russia-Ukraine war, while it should also put more efforts into Yemen to save the lives of millions of women and the children.
Monsoon rains are still pounding Pakistan, hampering all sorts of communications in key cities and towns in four provinces of the country. Roads, houses, hotels and buildings, along with other infrastructures, have been washed away by the flood waters. Southwestern Balochistan and northwestern Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces are now in the spotlight due to the sheer magnitude of devastation witnessed there in recent days. That's while millions of Pakistanis ravaged by extreme flooding are still awaiting relief in remote rural areas.
As far as government support is concerned, I think they supported only 50%. A lot of complaints from the local communities that there is no support received so far from the government. They are demanding shelters, food items, and a lot of other things.
Across large swaths of Pakistan, houses, schools, roads, and bridges have been destroyed. Floods also left thousands displaced and struggling to find safety along with their livestock. Meanwhile, Shehbaz Sharif has visited the heavily affected areas. He has already appealed to the international community to send aid and relief to help them deal with the devastation.
We are doing our best to help flood-affected people. The 30 years record of monsoon has been broken this year. The situation is demanding that we all should rise above the politics and to help the flood victims to overcome their miseries.
Pakistan is 8th on the Global Climate Risk Index for being one of the most vulnerable countries in the face of extreme weather caused by climate change. The country witnessed more rain than ever recorded this monsoon season.
It has been a year since the U.S. missile withdrawal from Afghanistan and the Taliban takeover of the country. During the pullout, thousands of Afghans flocked to airports in hope of leaving the country along with the U.S. forces. Zaki was one of them. As the Taliban encircled Kabul on August 15, hundreds of Afghans swarmed the runway of Hamid Karzai International Airport, attempting to climb onto a U.S. Air Force transport plane. Zaki made his way to the front and clambered onto the plane's landing gear. As it accelerated past 120 miles per hour, he held tight. His body was found after he plunged from the U.S. military plane as it took off, one of the most tragic and indelible images in the final chapter of the U.S. campaign in Afghanistan. We spoke to Zaki's father 1 year after his son's death. It wasn't easy to convince him at first, but this is our mission, to be the voice of the voiceless.
I just want to see the pilot of the U.S. plane to understand how he could do this. The U.S. claims that it supports human rights, but this is a sheer lie. They kill innocent people. They have not even apologized to me for my son's death. I've waited for a year for a simple apology, but it never happened.
Zaki's brother, Zabih, also lost his life during the Taliban takeover. Many Afghans blame the U.S. for the loss of innocent Afghan lives during the Washington's withdrawal.
There is no doubt that Americans are responsible for such incidents. They caused a chaos and it got out of their control. They knew such events might occur. Falling from planes or getting killed in explosions were the result of Americans' irresponsibility and mismanagement.
The cemetery where Zaki is buried is so close to his house that his father always looks at it through the window of his house every day. We asked him to take us to the cemetery where Zaki's grave is located.
The United Nations is also on their side, and so are the so-called human rights groups. The UN and the human rights are just a lie, as they are simply deceiving people. They are more like a mafia, but an official type. They must somehow pay compensation.
1 year has passed since the U.S. pulled its forces out of Afghanistan, ending almost two-decade occupation of the country. Yet no one has stood trial for the tragedy that happened during their withdrawal. There has been neither any compensation nor an apology that could at least calm those who lost their loved ones. Abdullah Hamirzad of Kabul.
The enemy is 600 meters away, and Russian snipers are zeroing their rifles to take down the target. The International Snipers Competition, which has been challenging top-grade shooters from seven countries, including Russia, China, and Azerbaijan, in the Iranian city of Yazd. After 10 days of breathtaking competition, the hosting Iranian teams made it to the top of the podium.
Thank God, the Iranian team won the first place. But what's important is that we as the host have maintained the fair play principle, and this is what the participating teams also admitted, that the refereeing was fair and transparent.
The Chinese team claimed the second place, and the Russian Federation and Uzbekistan jointly rounded off the podium in the third place.
We tried our best to win the top of the podium, but the competition was so tight. I hope we will perform better next year.
Before the competition, we thought we could achieve the first place, but the Iranian snipers are so capable and gave us stiff competition.
Organized by the ground force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the 10-day competition was held in 20 different items, which engaged the snipers in arduous team and individual competitions to test their agility and shooting accuracy in various war conditions.
The competition comprises 20 different items. Some of them are team competitions and others are individual competitions. The contest tries to challenge the competitors' skills in shooting, physical preparedness, and promptitude, among others.
The event came as part of Russia's International Army Games 2022, which hosted over 270 teams from 37 countries and regions. From taking down moving objects to shooting at distant targets, the International Snipers Competition offered a real challenge for some of the select shooters from different countries. So organizers say those who made it to the top are among the most capable shooters in the world. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Yazd.
Hundreds of people attended the Friday prayer in front of the Red Cross office in the Gaza Strip.
in a move to express their sympathy and unity with Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails and detention centers. They came to drum up support for Palestinian prisoners who kicked off a series of protests last Monday against persistent mistreatment inside regime jails. The event is part of the Friday of Rage in solidarity with Palestinian detainees. During the Friday sermon, Hamas movement warned the Israeli regime against harming Palestinian prisoners.
Our military wings, including the Qassam and Quds brigades, and the military wings of all Palestinian resistance factions, are all united behind the prisoners. We will spare no effort to secure the release of the prisoners. Harming Palestinian prisoners is an attack on all Palestinian resistance factions.
Over the past 4 days, Palestinian detainees held in 24 Israeli prisons have refused to take part in security checks and returned their meals. They also organized sit-ins in prison yards as part of their protest action.
The Israeli prison service reneged on understandings that were previously reached with prisoners' representatives. It imposed punitive measures, including moving tens of detainees to solitary confinement, preventing inmates from going to the prison yard, and banning prisoners from meeting their families. In response to this, the Palestinian prisoners have declared the state of general mobilization last Monday.
In recent weeks, the Israeli prison service increased its oppressive measures against Palestinian prisoners by imposing double isolation on some detainees. Observers say the Palestinian prisoners have become propaganda material for candidates in Israel's elections.
Palestinian prisoners are escalating their actions because they demand better detention conditions. The suffering of Palestinian prisoners increases every time the Israeli regime plans to hold elections. Israeli officials are using the oppression of prisoners as part of their election campaigns.
Currently, there are some 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons, and that figure includes women and children. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has detained more than 1 million Palestinians since the Nakba in 1948, under the watchful eye of the international community. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
If you're a British citizen waiting for a package to be delivered by Royal Mail, expect a delay. More than 100,000 of the company's workers, hailed as heroes for working through the pandemic, have walked out of the job to fight for a wage rise amid a deepening cost of living crisis.
To come into this action, to get your members motivated.
We didn't create this crisis. The oligarchs in every society, the people that are taking dividends and profits, feeding their own fat tummies and making our people wait for a decent pay rise. That's what's causing inflation, but it's also what's causing bitterness between the classes. Now, we've got to make sure that we rebalance that equation.
The bosses at Royal Mail, a 500-year-old multinational, now privatized postal service, claims the Communication Workers Union, which represents these strikers, has rejected a pay rise offer worth up to more than 5% after 3 months of talks. The union's leader says that's simply not true.
The reason why it's a lie is because it doesn't exist. It's a total fabrication, and it's being spun to the media, embarrassingly, really, to try and make the company look as though they're being reasonable when what they're actually doing is just disgraceful. So the real situation is that the company made £758 million profit. The company gave away over £400 million to major shareholders and then imposed a 2% pay increase to the workforce.
The walkout is being described as the biggest industrial action of the summer so far, which has already seen workers strike across the railways, ports and the courts. They all come at a time when the UK is grappling with its highest inflation rate and soaring energy prices in decades.
Today's strike action is the opening salvo in a dispute that could reshape a British institution. And the strikers tell us that they're in it for the long haul. Saeed Purizza, London.
Iwan has held an automotive exhibition titled The New Era of Iwan's Automotive Industry. The event provides an opportunity for auto parts manufacturers and automakers to establish better bonds and meet the needs of the industry and the market through joint cooperation.
We have plans to reform the structure of our automotive industry as well as the relations between auto parts manufacturers and automakers. Moreover, under the plan, the overall promised production target will be achieved in 2025.
According to a report released by the International Organization of Motor Vehicle Manufacturers, OICA, Iran has been ranked the world's 19th biggest automaker in 2021. Based on the OICA data, Iranian automakers produced almost 900,000 vehicles in 2021. That marked a 2% increase compared to 2020.
We have done a lot of work in the automotive industry, but there is still much to do. A car has more than 2,000 parts, and every day 4,000 cars are produced in the country. We do not have any other industries with such managerial, economic, and technological complexities.
The Iranian manufacturers currently produce 6 different types of vehicles, including passenger cars, 4WD trucks, buses, minibuses, and pickup trucks. The sector has directly employed about 500,000 people and many more in related industries. About 75% of local output is passenger cars, while pickups come in the second place with around 15%.
The auto industry is a key driving force in Iran, the operation and prosperity of which keeps almost 60 other industries moving. The industry is only second to its energy sector, accounting for almost 10% of the gross domestic product. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Last year, when U.S. military forces were withdrawing from Afghanistan, thousands of foreign and Afghan citizens were also trying to get out of the country. In those days, thousands of people gathered outside the airport in the hope that they can go inside and catch a flight out. But American and NATO forces failed to control the situation, and then came a disaster. This side of the canal is where U.S. soldiers were standing, using the barbed wire not to let people pass. And this canal is where people were trying to pass and get over the ridge. The explosion also killed plus 183 persons.
I saw people, including women and children, who were running. There were people carrying the wounded with wheelbarrow. Many of the dead and wounded people were thrown into the canal. Women were running and screaming, trying to get to the hospital. We were so close, so we went there and did what we could do to help them.
It was around 6 p.m. when a suicide bomber entered a crowd of disturbed people and detonated his vest just outside the International Airport of Kabul on August 26th last year. At least 183 people were killed, including 170 Afghan civilians and 13 members of the United States Army. Some say all that blood is on the hands of the Americans.
In my opinion, Americans are solely responsible for that disaster. The chaos around the airport was deliberately created by the Americans as a cover to allow them to escape. On the other hand, they were aware that such incidents are probable. So why didn't they stop the evacuation process? Why didn't they disperse the people?
Also, some citizens blame gunfire by U.S. troops after the explosion for at least some of the deaths.
We can't confirm that.
And the Pentagon in a conference acknowledged that possibly U.S. was responsible for some deaths, but later on they said that ball bearings in the explosive vest created holes in bodies resembling bullet holes. Although this explanation sounds so fishy, it is still not known if gunfire caused some deaths or not. Just hours before the attack, U.S. diplomats in Kabul warned citizens to stay away from the city's airport. They were aware of what was about to come, but were not willing to take any steps towards preventing it. Abdullah Amirzad of Kabul.
Thousands of people rallied in the Gaza Strip to celebrate the Islamic Jihad's victory against the Israeli regime and assert the unity among Palestinian resistance groups. Earlier this month, Israeli forces assassinated a top Islamic Jihad military commander in Gaza, prompting retaliatory attacks by Palestinian resistance movements. Israeli forces killed 49 Palestinians, including 17 children, during the 3 days of fighting. The Islamic Jihad maintains that it has achieved an honorable victory in the latest confrontation with the Israeli regime. Addressing the rally through satellite transmission, Islamic Jihad Secretary General Ziad al-Nakhala praised the unity among all Palestinian resistance groups during the three-day war.
The thousands of people attending this rally today are proof that all Palestinian resistance factions are united against the Israeli enemy. We assert today during this victory and unity rally that armed resistance is the only way to liberate Palestine and regain our rights.
The popularity of Islamic Jihad movement continues to gain momentum among Palestinians due to its refusal to recognize the Israeli regime and its adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli occupation. During the 3 days of intense fighting, the Islamic Jihad rockets shattered Israel's so-called invincibility myth.
Al-Quds Brigade is sending a very strong message today to the Israeli enemy regarding the growing might of the Palestinian resistance. The enemy thought that assassinating Al-Quds Brigade commanders will weaken the Islamic Jihad, but that did not happen. Al-Quds Brigade are stronger today than ever and will continue to fight for the sake of liberating Al-Quds.
During the 3 days of fighting, the Islamic Jihad military wing fired hundreds of rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories. Observers say that the Islamic Jihad fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime, forcing Tel Aviv to demand a ceasefire.
The strength of the Palestinian resistance has forced the Israeli enemy to ask for a truce. The Palestinian resistance is here to protect the Palestinian people and to liberate our land. The Al-Quds brigades have managed to fire hundreds of rockets at the enemy and forced it to evacuate their towns and run for cover.
Five wars have been unleashed between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza since 2008.
Experts believe that in any future war, the Israeli regime will be dealt a heavy blow by Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's ongoing war against the Palestinians aims to extinguish their spirit of resistance, but they have become even more steadfast in their fight for justice and liberation. says Sami Al-Aryan, writer, in an article published under the heading Zionist Regime Attacks, Western Collusion, and the High Price of Palestinian Freedom. Stay tuned for more. On the morning of Friday, August 5th, 5-year-old Ala Qadoum woke up in her Shajaiya home in the center of Gaza, excited that her grandfather would be coming to take her to buy a new school uniform and backpack. She had been dreaming of that day all summer ahead of her first day of kindergarten in just a few weeks. But before Ala could set out on her shopping trip, her home was hit by an Israeli regime airstrike. She was killed instantly. In Rafah, in the south of Gaza, Abir Harb, a 24-year-old student studying information technology, went to visit her fiancé, 30-year-old Ismail Dawig, to go over wedding plans. Ismail, who looked after his elderly mother, owned a small business he had been hoping to grow in order to provide for expanding family. Abir was very happy that day because Ismail had phoned her father for permission to set a wedding date, but the meeting never happened. A day later, Ismail's body was recovered from the under the rubble of his home. He was found tightly hugging his mother as their house was obliterated by an Israeli regime missile. On the same day, in the Jabalia refugee camp in north of Gaza, Najwa Abu Hamda was not prepared for the devastating news she was about to receive. Her 19-year-old son, Khalil, had been killed in an airstrike. Just that morning, Najwa, who struggled for 15 years before having her only child through fertilization, told neighbors that she and her husband hoped Khalil would get married soon and bless them with grandchildren. Their hopes for the future are irrevocably destroyed by this unimaginable loss. In the Bourajji refugee camp in the east of Gaza, 45-year-old Sheikh Yasser tried to soothe his three children as the terrifying hum of Israeli regime warplanes hovered above. Within a few minutes, however, the judicial officer and part-time religious teacher, his 13-year-old twins, Muhammad and Dalia, and his 9-year-old son, Ahmad, were incinerated by an Israeli regime missile. Only Yasser's mother and wife survived. The next day, on August 6, in the Jabalia refugee camp, 11-year-old Rahaf Soleiman stepped out of her house at around sunset to call out to her brother to come home for dinner. Without any warning, she was hit by a Zionist regime missile, causing the tiny girl to lose her right hand and both legs. Regardless of which part of Gaza one lived, 45 Palestinians, half of whom were women and children, were killed. In those 55 hours of hell, more than 360 others were injured and maimed because of the Zionist regime's appetite to punish, target, and subjugate Palestinians in Gaza. The Zionist regime's military aggression began that morning with an unprovoked targeted assassination of a commander of Islamic Jihad, one of the main Palestinian resistance groups. The use of violence has long been a tactic by Israeli regime leaders in the midst of their election campaigns for political gain. Shimon Peres tried it during his political campaign in April 1996. When the Zionist regime committed the Kano massacre, killing more than 100 children. As he was launching his re-election campaign, Ehud Olmert waged a devastating three-week war on Gaza in December 2008, which claimed the lives of 1,400 Palestinians including nearly 500 women and children, with thousands more injured. In May 2021, as Benjamin Netanyahu was preparing for his own re-election bid after several inconclusive elections, he unleashed the full force of the Israeli regime killing machine for 12 days on Gaza, resulting in more than 260 Palestinians killed and thousands more injured, and thousands of homes, buildings and businesses destroyed. Similarly, the war this month was an attempt by the current Israeli regime leaders, Yair Lapid and Benny Gantz, to gain political ground over right-wing opposition leader Netanyahu before heading to the polls in November. Interestingly enough, all Israeli regime leaders mentioned lost their re-election bids after none of these military campaigns managed to achieve their goal of vanquishing the enemy and gaining a decisive victory. But what has been consistent throughout the Zionist regime's vicious wars is Western leaders' callous mantra that Israel has the right to defend itself, ruthlessly giving the fake regime of Israel a license to kill any Palestinian it perceives as a threat or an obstacle to its designs. By colluding with the fabricated regime of Israel, Western governments have been sending an unmistakable message that Palestinian lives are expendable. Freedom and human rights do not matter. The rule of law, democratic values, justice and equality are selective, and security and peace are not universal guarantees. Yet Palestinians are not oblivious to the tremendous sacrifices they have endured against the assault of the Zionist regime for decades. Palestinians mourn every victim and cry over every child. There is not a Palestinian home that is not scarred by a tragedy of a loved one killed, maimed, injured, arrested or imprisoned, or a home demolished, bombed or razed, a land confiscated or a tree uprooted. Each time the Zionist regime launches an attack on Palestinians, it aims to extinguish their spirit of resistance and pressure them to give up their rights. But in the face of such brutality and disregard for human life, the people become even more determined and steadfast in their fight for justice and freedom. Sooner or later, the world will recognize that the path of ignoring the plight of millions of people by supporting a settler colonialist project and arming it with superior military power against children, mothers, young brides and grooms, and ordinary people is immoral and unsustainable. Conscientious people across the world know that as well, as Nelson Mandela had once observed. We know too well that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to your favorite program, Youth Station. I'm your host, Zainab, and I have with me my co-host, dear
yes.
Asma. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
How are you?
Now that I'm with you, I'm just fine.
Mm-hmm. Asma, are we today's youth?
Well, no. I am happily going to sign out for this proclamation that I'm a classical youth.
Or like traditional youth. Mm-hmm. How does it differ with the modern youth?
Modern youth are just, I don't know, I usually think...
Pretty mature than us.
No, not just like that, you know. I think they are very much different. I don't know if it's safe to call it this way. I don't want to just do injustice to some of the youth. But the youth that I'm seeing right now around me, they're so materialistic. Okay. And unfortunately, some of them are so superficial.
Yeah.
And they do not dig deep. They do not study too much. They just go for the beauties of life and the pleasures. And they do not care about what is beyond. You know what I mean?
Yes, I got it.
That's the conception of modern youth that I have in my brain. And if this is the bad point about them, I have some good points as well. For example, they might be more active than the older generations. But still, those things that I talked about, the points of the modern youth, mm-hmm. has always, you know, put me in a side that I feel like...
You do not want to be a part of modern youth.
Yeah.
When you see them, look at them.
I hardly don't. What has changed in them?
I think the world around them, the mm-hmm. things that are being fed to them.
The speed.
I think the time was running all the time the same way. There's no fast forward in time. There's no...
Yes, Zainab, there is. And the internet has changed everything. There is much of a speed in your life. Now, it's no longer like 20 years earlier, like 50 years earlier. And now I'm not talking about 200 years earlier. But if you consider now with the... previous years, I would say that in past, maybe we had more of time to sit in a corner and ponder on the beauties of life, on nature, and on the meaning of different things that are very much important, and they are considered to be the essence and the core of life.
Yeah.
But right now, as they just...
So you believe like time is running fast right now, and I had a little difference of opinion. Mm-hmm. And what was that? I'll talk on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
I'm your host, Zainab, and I have with me my co-host, Asma, and we're talking about modern youth and, as Asma said, classical or old youth. And she actually puts herself in the category of old youth. She doesn't want to be a part
with
of
all
modern
the pleasure.
Youth.
I talked about the points regarding the
modern youth,
and I was asking you about the good points, if you have any.
I don't find many, but there are still a lot of youth who have access to internet, who have access to more knowledge, and they're applying it in a very beautiful way.
Yeah, that also is a thing.
They're more creative.
Yes,
they're more creative at a very early age. They're more into research, more into different things. However, the internet world has kept them captivated into the fantasy world.
Double check to the word captivated.
And they have basically... You know, they really have captivated them.
Yeah,
and
they're
kept
just
them,
like prisoners, Zainab.
Kept them very away from the real life. So since our youth today is actually a bit deviated from the real life, they have a gap. They have a big gap with their real life. They can do a lot of things on social media, or they can chat with a lot of people. But when it comes to real life meetings, they cannot even utter a single word.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's again one of the bad points. I would say that's a good
point.
You
know,
but there are many youth who
them.
Have used it in a better way.
Yeah.
Who know how to communicate maturely. Who know how to communicate in a much better way. Who learn from internet and stuff. So there are many modern youth who are actually learning from whatever the resources they have. But unfortunately, many of them
are same prisoners.
Yeah. And remember when we talked about metaverse and we said that there would come a day in which every single person is going to have a private zone in a parallel world?
Yeah.
I would like to call it like a shell. This is what has happened to human beings generally. And since we're talking about the youth, I would say that internet has made youth
captivated, prisoners.
Captivated and prisoners in a small room of themselves, you know,
in their
I mean?
Own world.
Yeah, in their own world.
And unfortunately, each and every one of them is being hacked.
Yeah,
because their screens differ, and they don't even realize this, and they're less educated on that. Well,
so when they take their cell phones in their hands, or when they are just so much busy with their computers.
Or communicating with others, they're actually providing their information to get leaked.
They are losing the seconds
security.
Of their lifetime.
True.
Now, forget about security. The lifetime is just running.
Yeah.
And they are unaware of it. They could have been writers. They could have been great thinkers, philosophers, whatsoever, even poets.
Remind me of a joke. There was a joke going viral on the internet that was saying that a person who works very, very hard from morning to evening realizes how the time passed, but a person who is stuck in his mobile does not even realize how a year passed.
Yeah,
and that's
very true.
We can talk more on that note after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. I have with me my co-host Asma, and we're talking about the differences between modern youth and traditional youth. So Asma, what was the good thing about traditional youth?
The good thing about traditional youth?
You consider yourself to be a part of traditional youth.
Yes. Well, they go through too much of a studying books. They are mostly bibliophiles. They are interested in reading. They do too much of thinking. They go to nature. They spend time with their dear
ones. Stopping over here that they read a lot of books.
Yeah.
Why don't modern youth do that?
Because they think internet has provided everything for them. And when you can get everything you want at the moment you want it just by pressing a button, then why do you have to go?
Have you seen a modern youth who is watching a video on internet and it's, for example, say more than 10 minutes and they just scroll down, they don't want to see it?
Yeah,
because they want it fast, they want it now.
Yes
And this is a problem, because reading books is not very fast, it's not now, it requires your intellect, it requires your attention.
Yes,
it requires reasoning.
You have to,
and
your
logic.
Brain has to be engaged,
and internet has been designed in a way it does not allow you to go for more logic, more reasoning. You want it fast, you want it now happening.
Yeah, that's very true. As I just told you, their connection with nature was more and more,
because they were not living in the fantasy world.
Exactly. Yeah, they had more respect
to
nature.
Not living in the digital world, I must say.
Mm-hmm.
Because fantasies have always been there.
I'm not a fan of digital world, you know? That's why I call myself old-fashioned. What about you? Which one do you consider yourself? An old-fashioned one or a modern one?
I really don't want to be the part of this modern youth.
See?
Yeah, you know why? Because I think they're least responsible.
Yeah.
How much responsible?
And the respect, Zeynep.
I mean, the traditional youth had been responsible, mm-hmm. respecting, recognizing their roles,
mm-hmm.
much more.
We were just talking about respect. When I consider the youth right now around me, when their parents or even their grandfathers, grandmothers are talking to them, they did not pay too much of attention or respect, or not just that, for every single topic, I don't see them very much respectful.
You know why that happened?
Why?
Because the modern world is actually, the so-called modern world, I must say, is teaching us The everyday these slogans, these hashtags, these placards going on. It's my life, my choice. When you say my life, my choice kind of things, you become extremely self-centric.
Yeah.
You are not responsible anymore. You don't feel any responsibility towards even your parents or anyone else because you're being taught constantly
Think about yourself and your benefits.
Be self-centric.
Yeah.
Be self-centric. Be selfish.
Mm-hmm.
Indirectly, that's what's being taught. So since we are being taught indirectly that, we are less responsible today. Or we see youth coming up very, very less responsible or very, very self-centric kind of youth or very much thinking about themselves. Important thing that I really hate about modern youth, or I must say most of the women, especially most of the females, is that they're putting a lot of attention on their body image.
Yeah, that's very true.
I mean, just look at it. Did you see traditional youth going for surgeries just to look beautiful?
Now,
was,
you know,
was the looks that really mattered?
There is no problem with doing surgeries, you know, because some of the people, that was an improvement.
Until and unless you don't
science.
Have burns on your body, you have not met an accident.
Yeah.
You are not required
we actually
to go
are
for
talking
unnecessary
of-
just to show off in this materialistic world wherein you're supposed to kind of be very much modest, you're kind of supposed to be less visible as a female. But here, the world is teaching you, no, you should have a model-like figure, which is not possible, which is not, because the research says 99% of it is not actually possible.
You know, the gist of it is that the beauty is no longer deep skin.
Exactly.
So it has come, it has came out to be on the surface.
Yes.
Just what I told you. They have become so superficial. If you are not just going like the crowd, if you're not moving like the entire current, then you no longer belong to these people. So that's it. We were talking about modern youth.
Modern youth and traditional youth. So the modern youth today, whether we are part of it or not, we should try to stick to some good qualities from the traditional ones and also learn from the very modern things that we have, accessories we have. Use them in a better way, basically, because everything that we are concluding over here is because a user-dependent thing, the access to technology that we have, it's all user-dependent, so it's the way you use it. So use tech in the best possible way, educate yourself, increase your knowledge, and read books.
Yeah.
Well, with that, just analyze all these things. Just analyze the things that we talked about, traditional youth, and compare that we talked about the modern youth, and just keep yourself in the frame, which frame you belong to. Do you belong to modern youth or you want to be a part of traditional youth? As Asma and me, we want to stick to traditional
exactly.
ones. Well, thank you so much, Asma, for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.